Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 161. It's Monday, May 2nd. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID is still alive and well in Lucas County, in Ohio, and in America. We'll get to the local update in a minute here, but I just wanted to comment on happening this weekend, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. There was a lot of brouhaha about COVID mitigation efforts, and this is probably a pretty good example of the haves and the have-nots. So there was all questions about, you know, vaccination status and testing and masking and whether you're going to attend at all, this kind of thing. Even putting UV disinfecting lights, which they decided no. The one thing that I thought was notable in all of this is that there were no employee mitigation efforts required. This points, I think, to the invisibility of workers. Of course, not having employees doing mitigation strategies, having servers, people in the kitchen, that type of thing, you are actually putting them at risk and they are putting you at risk. To actually pretend they don't exist is a frustratingly obvious to me and apparently not to a lot of people about just the invisibility of workers. And of course, this kind of invisibility, this kind of blindness we have is part of the reasons why public health problems and particularly infectious disease problems are difficult to solve, because we worry about one set of people and not another. Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. For some context, nationally, cases have gone up by 50% in the last 2 weeks, and cases have gone up over 80% in Ohio over the last 2 weeks. In Lucas County, the case rate has kind of gone up and down. It's an average reported cases of 63 per day over the last week, and this is the same as it was a few weeks ago. It's kind of gone up and down, but this number still represents the hot spot in Ohio, and the state as a whole is increasing. Unfortunately, as I reported in earlier episodes, it's getting increasingly difficult to rely upon case numbers. Test positivity is a little bit better, and unfortunately, we're seeing a sharp rise in test positivity rates. It's up to 7.5% in Lucas County, 7.7% in Ohio, and 6.8% in the U.S. Each of these has gone up pretty precipitously in the last couple weeks. The problem with interpreting these is that the testing volumes as a whole have gone down, and of course, most testing is not even reported, so it's very difficult. When test positivity is going up and number of tests is going up, you definitely have a trend. If testing is relatively stable and testing positivity is going up or down, then you can pretty reliably guess what the trend is. But with testing going down and positivity going up, it's a little bit more difficult. But the bottom line is that clearly we're seeing an increase in COVID, and we're at levels that are considered high by the CDC, even their new categories, which are more stringent. Of course, we're not in the warning zone because we haven't hit the hospitalization numbers, but the case rates are the forerunners of those. And getting to that, hospitalizations are increasing in Ohio and the U.S. Okay, well, in nursing homes, we haven't seen a lot of activity. It's gone up a little bit over the last couple of weeks, still relatively low historically. We had 9 residents and 5 staff in the most recent week reported that have active COVID-19 cases. Fortunately, we've had no more deaths in the last couple of weeks from long-term care facilities in Lucas County. Kind of a similar case with UT. There was 11 cases identified, but their asymptomatic random testing has actually gone down in the most recent, and school is coming to a close. So probably the story for UT is over, at least until perhaps the fall starts. Well, the bottom line really with COVID is not so much the cases, but hospitalizations and deaths. And while hospitalizations are rising, deaths have been coming down, although they may be very well leveling off. We're down to about 300 cases per day. This is low from what we've been over the last even 5 or 6 months. And not quite getting as low as the low we got last summer, which we dipped just under 200 cases per day. But looking at in proper context, 300 deaths per day is a pace of over 100,000 deaths per year. And that is in the range of that cluster of causes of death around third, fourth, fifth causes of death, leading causes of death. Okay, well, let's get to some COVID articles. And I think this first one really characterizes where we're at with the pandemic in the U.S. today. This from the Washington Post. COVID deaths no longer overwhelmingly among the unvaccinated as toll on elderly grows. Experts say numbers show importance of boosters and the risks that the most vulnerable still face. Unvaccinated people accounted for the overwhelming majority of deaths in the United States throughout much of the coronavirus pandemic. But that has changed in recent months, according to a Washington Post analysis. The pandemic's toll is no longer falling almost exclusively on those who chose not to or could not get shots. With vaccine protection waning over time and the elderly and immunocompromised, who are at greatest risk of succumbing to COVID-19, even if vaccinated, having a harder time dodging increasingly contagious strains. The vaccinated made up 42% of fatalities in January and February during the highly contagious Omicron variant surge, compared with 23% of the dead in September, the peak of the Delta wave, according to the CDC. As a group, the unvaccinated remain far more vulnerable to the worst consequences of infection and are far more likely to die than people who are vaccinated, and they are especially more at risk than people who have received a booster shot. It's still absolutely more dangerous to be unvaccinated than vaccinated, said Andrew Neumer, public health professor at the University of California, Irvine, who studies COVID-19 mortality. A pandemic of and by the unvaccinated is not correct. People still need to take care in terms of prevention and action if they are symptomatic. A key explanation for the rise in deaths among the vaccinated is that COVID-19 fatalities are again concentrated among the elderly. Nearly 2/3 of the people who died during the Omicron surge were 75 and older, compared with a third during the Delta wave. Seniors are overwhelmingly immunized, but vaccines are less effective and their potency wanes over time, especially in older age groups. The bulk of vaccinated deaths are among people who did not get a booster shot, according to the state data provided to the Post. In 2 of the states, California and Mississippi, 3/4 of the vaccinated senior citizens who died in January and February did not have booster doses. Regulators in recent weeks have authorized second booster doses for people over the age of 50, but administration of first booster doses has stagnated. And as a reminder that what we do makes a difference, not to be fatalistic about this COVID-19 pandemic, this from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Modeling study shows geographical disparities in U.S. COVID deaths. Since May 31st, 2020, the South experienced COVID-19 mortality 26% higher than the national rate, whereas the Northeast rate was 42% lower. So, my friends, that's a 68% spread in mortality. If every region had the same mortality as the Northeast, more than 316,000 COVID deaths between May 31st, 2020 and September 26, 2021 could have been avoided. And, of course, that's not including the latest Omicron surge. And more variants are coming. This from the Associated Press. South Africa's latest COVID surge blamed on Omicron mutant. South Africa is seeing a rapid rise in COVID-19 cases driven by yet another version of the coronavirus. Cases had been dropping in the country since February, but new Omicron subvariants that scientists call BA4 and BA5 began pushing up cases last week and they have risen rapidly since. South Africa is recording just over 6,000 cases a day, up from a few hundred just a few weeks ago. The proportion of positive tests jumped from 4% in mid-April to 19% last Thursday, according to official figures. And a little blast from the past, this from The Hill. Burke says U.S. must prepare for summer COVID surge as immunity wanes. Deborah Burks, a leading member of the Trump administration's White House Coronavirus Task Force, said on Sunday the U.S. should be prepared for another potential COVID-19 surge after a recent uptick in infections in South Africa. Each of these surges are about 4 to 6 months apart, she says. That tells me that natural immunity wanes enough in the general population after 4 to 6 months that a significant surge is going to occur again. And this is what we have to be prepared for in this country. And as a reminder that having treatments doesn't mean those treatments will be used, this from Reuters. Awareness and use of COVID treatments is low. Fewer than 2% of non-hospitalized high-risk patients with COVID are receiving drugs that can limit the extent of their illness, survey results suggest. Among individuals older than 65, whose age puts them at risk for severe COVID-19, 66% were aware of treatments and 36% had sought them, but only 1.7% reported use of such drugs. So 36% sought them and only 1.7% actually got them. And an enduring dynamic of this pandemic, this from the Associated Press as well, racial split on COVID-19 endures as restrictions ease in U.S. Black Americans, 63%, and Hispanic Americans, 68%, continue to be more likely than white Americans at 45% to say that they are at least somewhat worried about themselves or a family member being infected with COVID-19, according to an April poll from the Associated Press Center for Public Affairs Research. 71% of Black Americans say they favor requiring face masks for people traveling on airplanes, trains, and other types of public transportation. That's more than 52% of white Americans who support mask mandates for travelers. 29% of white Americans are opposed. Among Hispanic Americans, 59% are in favor and 20% are opposed. The poll was conducted before a ruling by a federal judge scuttled the government's mask mandate for travelers. That was a couple weeks ago. And that happened to be just before my first air travel of the pandemic and in many years. I did a little poll in the airport, and I saw that 19 out of 100 people that sequentially had walked by me were wearing a mask in the terminal. I think it wasn't any higher in the airplane, but I couldn't get an exact count for that. But as a little sampling. So this shows that while many people support the policy, for instance, of having masks in airports and on airlines, when you actually remove the restrictions, way more people don't abide by the good idea. The law teaches. Okay, and a few stories about the lingering effects of COVID-19. First up from Medical Express, contracting COVID-19 might increase your risk for type 1 diabetes. People have been diagnosed with COVID-19 may be at a higher risk of developing the autoimmune disease type 1 diabetes, according to a study of more than 27 million people across the United States. Researchers found that patients who were infected with SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, were 42% more likely to develop type 1 diabetes than those who did not contract COVID-19 during the study period. The risk is highest among the youngest of pediatric patients. Those under the age of 1 were at an increase of almost sixfold, and elevated among older adult patients with COVID-19. The researchers also observed differences across race and ethnicity, with risk of type 1 diabetes associated with COVID-19 infection being most pronounced among American Indian Alaskan Native, 130% increase risk, Asian Pacific Islander, twofold increase, and Black patients, a 60% increase. Particularly in pediatric populations, COVID-19 is not usually a life-threatening, oftentimes not serious condition. But type 1 diabetes is usually a lifetime illness that requires dramatic amounts of contact with the medical community, increases your risk of death, and increases your risk of long-term comorbidity. Our interest is really looking at the question, Are there going to be hidden costs even among those who are not at high risk for COVID itself because of COVID later on? There's other evidence that links COVID-19 infection to increased risk of being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. SARS-CoV-2 is not the first virus to be associated with increased risk of type 1 diabetes onset. It has also been linked to several viral infections such as mumps, rubella, cytomegalovirus, and the Epstein-Barr virus. This study focused on COVID-19 cases in the absence of vaccines. That's important to note that these are unvaccinated folks. The results may not have been bad among vaccinated folks. The next big question is to determine whether immunization against SARS-CoV-2 is linked to any further or minimized risk of type 1 diabetes. The research team also aims to study associations between 40 other autoimmune diseases and COVID-19 infections. If we think about just the burden of disease that COVID causes, it's quite possible that the immediate disease is going to have a much, much smaller impact, particularly on people who are at low risk from the disease itself. And we might end up with a huge number of lifelong disorders that develop from the exposure of COVID. And on a similar theme from the Washington Post, older people who get COVID are at increased risk of getting shingles. People 50 and older who have had mild case of COVID-19 are 15% more likely to develop shingles from the herpes zoster virus within 6 months than are those who have not been infected by the coronavirus, according to research published in the journal Open Forum Infectious Diseases. The risk, however, was found to be even greater for older people who are hospitalized because of a more severe COVID case, making them 20% more likely to develop shingles cases than those who did not have COVID. And in a very underreported side effect of ICU hospitalization, this from Stat News, majority of family members of COVID patients treated in the ICU reported PTSD symptoms. A majority of family members of COVID-19 patients treated in ICUs reported significant symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder in the following months. The prevalence of PTSD symptoms were roughly twice the rate typically seen after a family member's ICU stay before the pandemic, which the author said was likely explained by the lack of access to loved ones during their ICU stay. Those with higher scores reported more distrust of practitioners, according to the study published in JAMA Internal Medicine. And PTSD symptoms were especially prevalent among women and Hispanic family members. Generally, there are three reasons why a person might develop PTSD from having a loved one in the ICU: the sudden change in the health status of a loved one, and the need to make critical and stressful healthcare decisions for them, such as whether to put them on a ventilator or other life-sustaining therapies, and a loss of control due to the sudden handoff of care to unknown healthcare providers. Now, I think one of the most interesting facts hidden in here that I'd never really heard reported is that they're saying the prevalence of PTSD symptoms is roughly twice the rate typically seen after a family member's ICU stay. And since that's a majority of members of COVID-19 patients, that means that basically the typical rate of PTSD symptoms among people who have folks in the ICU is about 1/4 or 1 in 4. So that is normal. And COVID-19 about doubles the chance of having those PTSD symptoms. Okay, well, moving to some global stories related to COVID-19. This one's about infrastructure in Africa specifically. This from Reuters. South Africa's Aspen COVID-19 vaccine plant risked closure after no orders. America's first COVID-19 vaccination plant, touted last year as a trailblazer for an under-vaccinated continent frustrated by sluggish Western handouts, risked shutting down after receiving not a single order. With only a sixth of adults in Africa fully vaccinated, according to the latest World Health Organization figures from the end of March, Aspen's agreement to sell an Aspen-branded COVID-19 vaccine throughout Africa seemed like a sure bet. South Africa, which has vaccinated only 30% of its population, also looks set to experience a fifth wave of infections. African countries have struggled with logistical issues, lack of skilled staff, cold chains, and other problems surrounding the distribution of vaccines. Another issue is that after initially leaving Africa out in the cold, donor countries have since paid up and the continent is now well supplied with vaccines. In the long run, the aim was to shift to producing other vaccines, but that the firm had banked on these initial volumes to buy it time to establish its operation. If you don't breach the short-term gap with orders, you can't sustain these capacities on the continent, at a time when health officials want to vaccinate 3/4 of the continent's population. The African Union's goal is to produce 60% of all vaccines administered in Africa locally by 2040, up from the current 1%, and several such plants are being set up. If Aspen doesn't get production, what chance is there for any of the other initiatives? So true. Okay, next up, moving from how climate change can affect infectious diseases worldwide, this from Stat News. How climate change could drive animal movements and threaten more viral spillovers. Climate change will force animals to migrate, and in turn, some species and the pathogens they harbor will come into contact for the first time. In a new modeling study, scientists forecast that there could be more than 4,000 new cross-species swapping of viruses by 2070, even if warming is kept within the global target of 2 degrees Celsius. Bats, which carry pathogens like coronaviruses, account for most of the simulated viral sharing in the study, published in the journal Nature. There are also signs, the researchers said, that such an ecological transition might already be underway as the climate has started to warm. Climate change is a force that will compound other factors that have brought people and animals closer together, increasing the opportunities for viruses to jump from animals to people. But the threat of viruses spilling over from animals is not a hypothetical one. Just this last month, a spillover caused new Ebola cases in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The 2002-2003 SARS epidemic was ignited by a coronavirus that was passed from a bat through another animal into people. Many scientists think that the COVID-19 pandemic was touched off in a similar pattern. What's more, much of the anticipated migration of animals in response to changing climate could bring them closer to humans, meaning it's more likely that people will encounter a novel to them pathogen that could threaten their health. Climate change is increasing innumerable hotspots for future zoonotic risk or present-day zoonotic risk, zoonosis being the transfer of pathogens from other animals to humans. People aren't the only vulnerable ones. First encounters of species that don't normally live in the same ranges and the ensuing spread of viruses and parasites could threaten wildlife populations as well, the researchers noted. One key omission was birds, which carry viruses that are known to sicken humans, the researchers acknowledged. The new study also didn't look at mosquitoes. It's thought, for example, that a warming climate in the United States could expand the range of mosquitoes that are vectors for viruses such as Zika, dengue, and chikungunya. The researchers also found that the future hotspots where different mammals could overlap with each other are often in or near areas with lots of people, either places that are already settled or that are used for farming. This could bring viruses that are currently secreted away in forests closer to humans. This finding is consistent for bats and non-bats, the researchers wrote, and may be an accident of geography, but more likely represents the tendency of human settlements to aggregate on continental edges and around biodiversity hotspots. And next up from Stat News, Global Coalition seeks $4.8 billion for polio eradication initiative. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative said that it is seeking $4.8 billion to fund operations over the next 5 years aimed at finally ridding the world of polio. They said the world would save $33 billion this century by eradicating polio, compared to the cost of continually battling to contain it. Once again, prevention is cheaper than disease, and you avoid all that polio. In more infectious disease news, this from the Associated Press, Africa sees rise in measles as pandemic disrupts vaccines. Africa is seeing a surge of outbreaks of preventable diseases as a result of disruptions caused by the pandemic, said the World Health Organization. The continent recorded a 400% increase in measles to more than 17,000 cases between January and March compared to the same period last year. 2 years of disruption by the coronavirus pandemic have had major effects on the provision of routine health services, with immunization being seriously affected in many countries. 24 countries confirmed outbreaks of polio last year, 4 times more than in 2020. Last year, 13 countries reported new outbreaks of yellow fever, rising from 9 in 2020 and 3 in 2019, according to World Health Organization figures. The rise in outbreaks of other vaccine-preventable diseases is a warning sign, Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, the WHO Regional Director for Africa, said in a statement. As Africa works hard to defeat COVID-19, we must not forget other health threats. Health systems could be severely strained not only by COVID-19, but by other diseases. Yep, we have to continue to fight on multiple fronts. Okay, well, let's switch gears quite a bit here and go to a couple nutrition stories. First up from Medical Express. New article outlines the characteristics of a, quote, longevity diet. The authors report that the key characteristics of the optimal diet appear to be moderate to high carbohydrate intake from non-refined sources, low but sufficient protein from largely plant-based sources, and enough plant-based fats to provide about 30% of energy needs. Ideally, the day's meals would all occur within a window of 11 to 12 hours, allowing for a daily period of fasting, and a 5-day cycle of fasting or fast-mimicking diet every 3 to 4 months may also help reduce insulin resistance, blood pressure, and other risk factors for individuals with increased disease risk. They describe what eating for longevity could look like in real life. Lots of legumes, that's beans, peas, and lentils, whole grains, and vegetables, some fish, no red meat or processed meat, and very low white meat, low sugar and refined grains, good levels of nuts and olive oil, and some dark chocolate. I appreciate that last one being added in there, since that's one of my favorite little treats. Once or twice a day is a little square of 85% or more dark chocolate. Okay, in another very interesting nutrition story, and very different than what I usually report on, this from Science Daily. Evidence from a randomized clinical trial shows broad-spectrum micronutrient supplementation with all known vitamins and essential minerals resulted in global improvement of attention and mood based on blinded clinician ratings for those with ADHD. A study in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry reports that children with ADHD and emotional regulation randomized to take a micronutrient formula were 3 times more likely to show symptomatic improvement on blinded clinician ratings compared to those with placebo group, that is 54% versus 18% in the placebo group. The micronutrient formula, consisting of all known vitamins and essential minerals, was administered for 8 weeks. In addition to behavioral and emotional benefits, children taking micronutrients grew 6 millimeters more in height than those taking placebo after adjusted for baseline height. The growth finding, also a replication from the previous child micronutrient study, is particularly encouraging as height suppression is a concern with first-line ADHD medication. In contrast to clinician ratings, parents were also blinded to their child's treatment allocation, reported significantly improved behavior that was equal in both the micronutrient and placebo groups, with no significant between-group differences, highlighting the importance of blinded clinician ratings. So one of the reasons why I like this study is it's triple-blinded, meaning that the researchers, the clinicians, and the parents do not know which group they're assigned to, and the parents couldn't tell the difference. But it shows that the placebo effect works for parents. Parents were unable to differentiate a true effect among their children, but clinicians with a much more objective rating were actually able to measure a difference. Okay, no treatment is 100% effective for all with ADHD. For example, about 2/3 respond to the first stimulant drug tried, which is an established first-line ADHD treatment despite emotional appetite and growth side effects. So it's encouraging that a good half of the children responded to this relatively safe treatment. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and do some stories on guns and violence. This from MedPage Today. Women who live with gun owners more likely to take their own life. A woman's risk of dying by suicide was more than 40% higher after another adult in her household became a handgun owner, according to a retrospective cohort study of 9.5 million women. Rates of suicide were 1.4 times higher among women living with handgun owners compared to those living in handgun-free homes. And the higher rate of overall suicide was driven by a 4.3 times higher chance of dying by firearm suicide among women living with a gun owner compared with women who do not. The number of first-time gun owners in the U.S. has risen dramatically since the beginning of the pandemic. Yet 9 in 10 people living in homes with guns don't believe that factor contributes to their own increased risk of suicide. Most of the people who get guns, the great majority, are doing it because they want to protect, not imperil, the people in their home. And we know from this work and other studies that bringing a gun into the home is in fact doing just the opposite of what is intended. Given that 85% of the non-gun owner adults living in a household with gun owners are women, this study quantifies the, quote, imposed risk of firearm suicide and captures the increase when a cohabitating adult lawfully obtains a gun, he explained. It's increasing her risk of firearm suicide by more than 400%, and firearm suicide is the leading cause of firearm deaths among women. One limitation of the study, the researchers said, is that some women may have been miscategorized as living in homes without handguns when their homes were not gun-free. The guns were obtained unlawfully or before January 1985, when California's gun registry first started. So, instead of overestimating the magnitude of increased risk of suicide among women in households with guns, it would have underestimated the risk. So, if anything, the results are likely worse than what's shown here. Yikes, 400% chance of firearm suicide by women in a home with a gun. And moving to child and adolescents and arms, this from the New England Journal of Medicine, crossing lines, a change in the leading cause of death among U.S. children. Injuries are the most common cause of death among children, adolescents, and young adults between the ages 1 and 24 in the United States. Indeed, injuries are responsible for more deaths among children and adolescents than all other causes combined. For more than 60 years, motor vehicle crashes were the leading cause of injury-related death among young people. Beginning in 2017, however, firearm-related injuries took their place to become the most common cause of death from injury. This change occurred because of both the rising number of firearm-related deaths in this age group and the nearly continuous reduction in deaths from motor vehicle crashes. The crossing of these trend lines demonstrates how a concerted approach to injury prevention can reduce injuries and deaths, and, conversely, how a public health problem can be exacerbated in the absence of such attention. Between 2000 and 2020, the number of firearm-related deaths among children, adolescents, and young adults increased from about 7,000 to over 10,000, according to the CDC. So here we go. Public health in practice can reduce deaths, as the case with traffic injuries and deaths, but unfortunately, with firearms, deaths have been going up. And another story about youth and firearms, this from Medical Express. Rates of handgun carriage rise among U.S. adolescents, particularly white, rural, and higher-income teens, new study finds. From 2002 to 2019, the researchers found a 41% increase in rates of handgun carriage among youth overall, with white and higher-income youth now most likely to report carriage. Carriage rates among Black, American Indian, and Alaska Native, and lower-income adolescents decreased over the same time frame. Federal estimates based on the survey indicate that from 2019 to 2020, there were an additional 200,000 adolescents reporting that they carried a firearm compared to 2002-2003. And in more violence news, this from Medical Express, almost 90% of autistic women report experiencing sexual violence, often on multiple occasions. I must comment, I think of all the stories I've done today, this is one that's broke my heart the most, taking advantage of vulnerable people, women in this case. As many as 9 out of 10 autistic women in France report having suffered sexual violence, shows a new study in Frontiers in Behavioral Science. This is one of the largest studies to date focused specifically on this population. In contrast, previous research has shown that the rate of sexual aggression against non-autistic women is 1 in 3, suggesting that offenders are 3 times more likely to target autistic women. The results also revealed that most victims had been assaulted multiple times, that this began when they were young, and that they were rarely able to report the abuse or receive care. These findings will guide better prevention and treatment programs. Because of the young age of most victims at the first time of assault, the authors suggest that education strategies may not be the most effective means of prevention. Instead, they support large-scale programs to reduce systemic sexual violence and gender inequality, as proposed by the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And in more trauma news, this from Science Daily, U.S. civilian and military populations combined for more than $230 billion in annual costs for PTSD, A new study finds that the national economic burden of PTSD goes beyond direct healthcare expenses and exceeds the cost of other common mental health conditions such as anxiety and depression. The researchers estimated the cost of PTSD at $232 billion for 2018, the latest year for which data were available at the time of the study. They called for increased awareness of PTSD, more effective therapies, and the expansion of evidence-based strategies to reduce the large clinical and economic burden of that mental health condition. PTSD symptoms are well documented, re-experiencing the trauma through flashbacks and nightmares, avoidance of reminders of a traumatic event, changes in thoughts and feelings, such as guilt and emotional numbing, insomnia, and hyperarousal. In the study, the investigators brought to light the extent to which PTSD not only impacts veterans, but civilians as well. The research team found that civilians accounted for 82% of the total PTSD costs, compared with 18% for the military population. That disparity is predicated on the fact that the number of civilians far exceeds that of active duty military and veterans. Although PTSD is more prevalent in the military, the number of civilians with PTSD still tops the number of veterans with that condition. With the increasing occurrence of national and societal traumatic events around the world, including COVID-19, civil unrest, and climate change, there is mounting concern of an increase in PTSD and burden in the civilian population. As such, the current cost estimate is likely an underestimation, given that recent global traumas, the effects of which would not have been captured and are likely to result in increasing negative repercussions. The researchers also found that women represented 66% of the overall and 74% of the civilian population with PTSD, thereby contributing disproportionately to the national cost. Research has shown that trauma-exposed women show higher levels of PTSD symptoms than trauma-exposed men. Plus, trauma such as sexual assault and domestic violence tend to affect more women than men and represent important areas for prevention and treatment. And in a very interesting take on suicide and self-harm, this from Medical Express. Thinking about suicide and self-harming alleviates stress, new meta-analysis confirms. Nearly one-fifth of teens and young adults engage in self-injury, while just as many teens seriously consider attempting suicide. Both are considered a risk factor for suicidal behavior, but studies of why people harm themselves or think about suicide haven't been examined in a comprehensive way. Now, a new meta-analysis of 38 studies finds consistent results and themes that people engage in self-injury and or think about suicide to alleviate some type of stress, and that the perceived stress release that results from thoughts and behaviors indicates potential for therapy and other interventions. Researchers point to additional data on suicide, that a majority of people who die by suicide did not receive mental health treatment, for example, and consistent findings from the meta-analysis that stress precedes self-injury. They say this can inform prevention and intervention efforts, such as learning how to replace self-injury and suicidal thoughts with other means of reducing stress. And by the way, I have a bonus article that I'll give you at the end of the show that gets some of this. The good news is that we have effective behavioral interventions such as cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, which teach skills for managing intense emotions to replace self-injurious thoughts and behaviors. Increasing access to these types of treatments is likely to reduce the prevalence of them. Okay, let's move to a series of healthcare stories. First up from MedPage Today. Snapshot analysis shows unprecedented decline in RN workforce. The number of registered nurses plunged by 100,000 in 2021, representing the steepest drop in the RN workforce in four decades, according to a new analysis. The overall decline was not spread evenly across sites, but instead was entirely due to a 4% reduction in hospital employment, offset by a 1.6% increase in nursing employment in other settings, the author said. So, apparently, driven by the pandemic particularly, hospitals have become increasingly not a hospitable place to work. And next up, another story that shows that private profiteering in healthcare does not work well. This from USA Today. Watchdog says private Medicare plans denied nearly 1 in 5 claims that should have been paid. A government watchdog report found private Medicare plans routinely rejected claims that should have been paid and denied services that reviewers found to be medically necessary. The report, completed by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General investigators, discovered private Medicare plans denied 18% of claims allowed under Medicare coverage rules. The denials often were a result of errors in processing claims, the report found. The review also found private Medicare plans turned down 13% of authorizations for medical services that government-run Medicare would have allowed. Medicare Advantage plans tout perks such as limited out-of-pocket costs, vision and dental benefits not offered by traditional Medicare, and even gym memberships. But the plans employ private insurance industry tactics to reduce costs. These plans restrict networks of doctors and other medical providers people can use, mandate authorization for some services, and require referrals for specialists. It's time to go public, people. Get rid of the perversity of private profit for the public good of the people's health.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, folks, well, for as wonderful as healthcare for all would be, healthcare only affects about 20% of our overall health. 30% of it is what they call the social drivers of health or social determinants of health, and about 50% can be accounted for by individual behaviors. But of course, those individual behaviors are driven by social drivers of health as well. So with that in mind, this next story from Stat News. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services needs to include measures for social drivers of health. Every day, physicians encounter patients in their practices who show the toll of skipping meals to feed their children, or who cannot refrigerate their insulin because they have no electricity. They know that improving their patients' health is achievable only by addressing these and other social drivers of health, but are often limited in their ability to do that. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, could change that by enacting the first ever measures in a federal quality or payment program that offers incentives to physician practices and hospitals to engage their patients around these issues. A recent survey of Americans' physicians conducted by the Physicians Foundation found that 80% believe that, quote, the country cannot improve health outcomes or reduce healthcare costs without addressing social drivers of health. The Physicians Foundation, whose directors are appointed by 21 state and county medical societies, responded to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services' annual invitation for new Medicare measures by putting forward the first two social drivers of health measures ever proposed. These focus on the percentage of patients who are asked about food insecurity, housing instability, inadequate transportation, interpersonal safety, and difficulties paying for electricity and other utilities, and the percentage of patients who are positive for each of these needs. Even though CMS has declared it a priority to develop and implement measures that reflect social and economic determinants, these two measures are the only ones related to social drivers of health and are the only patient-level equity measures in this review cycle. Both measures are essential to fulfill CMS's commitment to health equity, articulated in its recently released Health Equity Strategy Pillar and its vision for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation and its associated health equity initiatives, all of which cite the importance of routinely and in standard ways, quote, collecting self-reported demographic and social needs data. Yes, folks, healthcare is way more than medical care. Public health demands a concern and a study of social drivers of health. Well, and one last medical story, which does have an interface between medicine and public health. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy from the University of Minnesota. Study finds disparities in improper antibiotic prescribing. When the researchers broke down the data on inappropriate prescribing, they found that nearly three quarters of the antibiotic prescriptions, 74% written for patients 65 and older, were inappropriate. They also found high rates of inappropriate antibiotic prescribing for all black patients, 64%, Hispanic patients, 58%, and men, 58%. The most common reasons for inappropriate antibiotic prescriptions were non-bacterial skin conditions, viral respiratory tract infections, and bronchitis. The study provides more evidence that rates of inappropriate antibiotic prescribing in U.S. outpatient settings may be even higher than previous studies have indicated. Among the most widely cited studies is a 2016 CDC published in JAMA that found that about 30% of oral antibiotics prescribed in U.S. outpatient settings are not necessary. But subsequent studies have found rates higher than 40%. And this new study indicates that inappropriate prescribing is even higher in certain demographic groups. That suggests U.S. outpatient antibiotic stewardship efforts have a long way to go. Our results underscore that strategies to reduce inappropriate prescribing must be tailored for outpatient settings. So beyond being medically unnecessary, it's not good for the patient. The public health interface here is that doing unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions leads to antibiotic-resistant pathogens floating around the world, which of course feeds back again into the medical care setting with multiple drug-resistant pathogens. Okay, well, let's go big with this next story from The Hill. 137 million in U.S. live with unhealthy levels of air pollution, says the American Lung Association. More than 40% of the U.S. population, or 137 million people, are living in areas with unhealthy levels of particle pollution or ozone, according to the American Lung Association's newest State of the Air report card. That's 2.1 million people living in counties with unsafe air compared to last year's card, and 8.9 million more people impacted by daily spikes in potential deadly particle pollution, the authors found. And in a more local pollutant, this from Stat News, FDA issues plan to ban menthol in cigarettes and cigars. The U.S. government last Thursday released its long-awaited plan to ban menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars, citing the toll on black smokers and young people. The proposed rules would help prevent children from becoming the next generation of smokers and help adult smokers quit. The ban would also be an important step to advance health equity by reducing disparities in tobacco-related diseases. The Food and Drug Administration said eliminating menthol cigarettes would prevent between 300,000 and 650,000 smoking deaths over the next 40 years. Menthol accounts for more than a third of cigarettes sold in the U.S., and the mint flavor is favored by black smokers and young people. Menthol's cooling effect has been shown to mask the throat hardness of smoking, making it easier to start and harder to quit. The FDA said it will also seek to ban menthol and dozens of other flavors like grape and strawberry from cigars, which are increasingly popular among young people, especially black teens. The agency's proposals on both cigarettes and cigars are only initial drafts and are unlikely to be finalized before next year. Companies would then have one additional year to phase out their products. Tobacco industry lawsuits could delay the prohibition for several more years, according to experts. For now, FDA leaders said they will take comments for 2 months and then proceed, quote, as expeditiously as possible. The sooner the better. Okay, well, next up, some more bad news about forever chemicals. This from Consumer Reports. New report links PFAS exposure to liver damage. You might have never heard of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, but it is now a global epidemic thought to affect roughly 25% of the world's population, including approximately 89 million Americans. It's a matter of grave concern because untreated, the condition can progress to serious liver injury, including cirrhosis and liver failure. Now, a new research review suggests that one contributing factor to rising rates could be PFAS, the ubiquitous chemicals used in nonstick pans, waterproof gear, firefighting foam, takeout containers, and more. Researchers have identified several conditions that put people at risk for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, including obesity, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. But scientists are still trying to understand all the factors contributing to the significant rise in cases. Previous research suggests that exposure to environmental chemicals such as PCBs, banned since the 1970s, but still found in the environment, could play a role. In the new review published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, researchers looked at both human and animal studies and found that exposure to PFAS may be a significant risk factor as well. Okay, well, sticking to the environmental chemicals theme, I did want to end on something much better news on that front. This from The Guardian. EU unveils plan for largest ever ban on dangerous chemicals. Thousands of potentially harmful chemicals could soon be prohibited in Europe under new restrictions, which campaigners have hailed as the strongest yet. Earlier this year, scientists said chemical pollution had crossed a planetary boundary, beyond which lies the breakdown of global ecosystems. The synthetic blight is thought to be pushing whale species to the brink of extinction and has been blamed for declining human fertility rates and 2 million deaths a year. The EU's restrictions roadmap was conceived as a first step to transforming this picture by using existing laws to outlaw toxic substances linked to cancer, hormonal disruption, reprotoxic disorders, I just learned a new word today, reprotoxic, I guess it's for reproduction toxicity, obesity, diabetes, and other illnesses. Industry groups say that up to 12,000 substances could ultimately fall within the scope of the new proposal, which would constitute the world's largest ever ban of toxic chemicals, according to the European Environmental Bureau. Tatiana Santos, the Bureau's chemicals policy manager, said EU chemical controls are usually achingly slow, but the EU is planning the boldest detox we have ever seen. Petrochemical industry lobbyists are shocked at what is now on the table. It promises to improve the safety of almost all manufactured products and rapidly lower the chemical intensity of our schools, homes, and workplaces. The plan focuses on entire classes of chemical substances for the first time as a rule, including all flame retardants, bisphenols, PVC plastics, toxic chemicals in single-use nappies, and PFAS, which are also known as forever chemicals because of the time they take to naturally degrade, which is close to forever. All of these will be put on a rolling list of substances to be considered for restriction by the European Chemicals Agency. The list will be regularly reviewed and updated before a significant revision to the EU's cornerstone REACH regulation for chemicals slated for 2027. Europe's REACH system is already the world's most extensive chemical register, and new bans could hit more than a quarter of the industry's annual turnover of around 500 billion euro, which I think, according to exchange rate, is on the order of 750 billion US dollars per year, according to a study by the trade group. Nevertheless, the European Chemicals Agency favors dealing with chemicals in groups because chemical firms had previously avoided bans on individual chemicals by tweaking their chemical composition to create sister substances that may also be dangerous, but which then require lengthy legislative battles to regulate. The industry tactic known as, quote, regrettable substitution has been criticized by environmental groups for allowing the replacement of substances such as endocrine disrupting bisphenol A with other bisphenols. Santos described it as a cynical and irresponsible tactic by the chemical industry to replace the most harmful banned chemicals with similarly harmful ones not yet on the regulatory radar. We've witnessed a decades-long pattern of regrettable substitution to avoid regulation. More than 190 million synthetic chemicals are registered globally, and a new industrial chemical is created every 1.4 seconds on average. Well, it's nice to see that a large regulatory agency is willing to take an environmentally regulatory scheme that's commensurate with a huge, widespread problem and the end runs that the chemical industry routinely takes. Okay, well, since last week, my episode was a greatest hits episode, and I had 2 weeks of articles to catch up on. You're getting a record number of 27 bonus articles. Feature these every week, and it's a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, all available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. First up, the debate over the COVID-19 public health emergency is failing America. We've got to have a just transition from emergency to a new normal. Two, the Government Accounting Office long-term COVID overview. This is a good one if you want to kind of see the current status of long COVID. Three, the race to unravel COVID's hidden link to Alzheimer's. Again, whew, so many things that are tied to COVID that are going to affect us in the long run. Four, no matter how you feel about masks, you should be alarmed by this judge's decision. This is related to the airline masking and transportation ban masking, which could be a terrible precedent for other public health emergencies that we don't even necessarily know about. That's part of the problem. We have a little bit of latitude for these emergencies. You can't predict everything with precision, so you got to have some latitude. Okay, five, understanding Black grief as a health disparity, both dealing with individuals and collectively, the grief in the Black community. Six, belittling, doubting, or blaming outdated medical language may harm patients. Seven, Republicans have stopped trying to kill Obamacare. Here is what they're planning instead. Eight, unprecedented increase in number of border wall falls and trauma. This is related to increasing the height. Try to climb over it and you fall, you're falling from about twice as far in many places. Nine, why do teens self-harm? Clinical psychologists explain how to help teens reduce their emotional distress. This is the one I referenced earlier in the show. 10, psychologists are starting to talk publicly about their own mental illnesses, and patients can benefit. Psychologists often limit self-disclosure, but this is a very human encounter. It can be very powerful. 11, the problem with preaching gratitude when toxic positivity meets mental illness. 12, okay, this is a series of stories related to women's health. Emergency contraception marks a new battle line in Texas. 13, these laws are making miscarriage more traumatic in America. 14, America lost its way on menopause research. It's time to get back on track. 15, mental health of college students is getting worse even before the pandemic. 16, study finds burnout epidemic for working women 2 years into pandemic. 17, residents enjoy better health after a switch to electric buses. I've reported on this before about noise levels and health. And in a related story, 18, Europe's noise capital tries to turn down the volume. 19, the unseen scars of those who kill via remote control, the drone operators. 20, climate change is making jobs deadlier, and OSHA can't take the heat, and workers are dying. 21, roles of cities in creating healthful food systems. This is a great policy one if you happen to know somebody who's interested in that. Great resource. And another more drilling down for the individual nutritional thing. 22, dietary supplements could be tainted with prescription medications and dangerous hidden ingredients. A must read for anybody who takes commercial dietary supplements. 23, a worldwide public health threat. Rob Bellott on his 20-year fight against forever chemicals. Yep, well, last night I watched that Dark Waters movie based on that story, and yikes. Thank goodness for folks doing the fight, but it takes a long time. It's a big fight against the chemical companies. But for those of you who are tired of environmentalists being dominated by white men, 24, a Black woman fought for her community and her life amidst polluting landfills. This is one of the most polluted places in America. And 25, all of my environmental heroes are Black women. A good primer is 26, how stress can damage your brain and body. And last but not least, 27, a new dimension to a meaningful life. Appreciating beauty in the everyday may be just as powerful as a sense of overarching purpose. You can see all of these stories and listen to the show if you want to again at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-